What's going on, everyone? I'm super excited for another awesome conversation about someone who has been the reason she has found success, but also has empowered and enabled many other individuals. And I'm excited to introduce Hannah Hunt. Hannah, welcome.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, super excited to have you. We've crossed paths the last couple of years, and now we can finally, I can help share your story because I think you have an awesome story and I'm excited to do so.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be on the Lock Mats podcast. You're like a cool kid.
You tell Angelica, you beat her to it.
Yeah. Oh, you know it.
Street cred.
Rub it in her face.
So, yeah, tell us the journey of who you are, how you got to where you are now, and you can go as back as kindergarten if you want, or adulthood. Just give us a little intro to who Harry is.
Yeah. Oh, that's a long story, but I'll say that for a lot of my childhood and young adulthood, I always wanted to work in the federal government. And I know it sounds cheesy, but I was 10 when 9/11 happened. And so I grew up with this us being attacked and then these long-term wars, and seeing how the U.S. interacted and engaged the world made me really interested in what we're doing, how we work together, cultures and country, some of the good, some of the bad. And I just knew I wanted to be a part of it and I wanted to help in any way I could. So I studied international affairs in my undergrad and my graduate programs, because I was really interested in how the world governs itself through different global governance type organizations like the United Nations or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. And I was like, I want to be a part of this. I think diplomacy is such a critical part of our foreign policy and that strategy. Went to school for that. My first job was at the State Department in the Protocol Office, and I was able to manage kind of large scale president and secretary level events and summits that kind of helped with our foreign policy initiatives. Moved over eventually to the DoD and started getting involved in strategic initiatives, public affairs, but also acquisitions, and starting to see like how the department acquires things. I worked for the JPEO for Chem Biodefense with their medical countermeasures team. So this is the drugs and vaccines that soldiers are given. So if you've ever been given the anthrax vaccine or the smallpox vaccine, that was my office. Sorry, it hurt. Sorry if you get a big bruise on your arm for it. So that kind of, I had always been looking for different and new innovative roles. I had an old coworker who worked at Kessel Run at the time. This was back in 2018, 2019. And Kessel Run was having a hiring fair. I was looking to get more ingrained in the federal government. And I applied, and amazingly, I was picked up, and lived in DC at the time and then moved to Boston. And I got tied in with the Agile Acquisitions BizOps team. And I learned all about different innovative ways to procure software and IT. At the time, I really just understood acquisitions from a Chem Biodefense perspective. But I got to work with some really amazing people that really mentored me and enabled me to be successful, like Matt Nelson and Angel and others. And I quickly got promoted to being the chief of staff, the first chief of staff of Kessel Run, and helped to scale the organization, focus on people, manpower and goals. But I was always really interested in the software side, the product side. As I was looking for my next opportunity after leaving KR, I got in contact with Erica, who's the director of the Army Software Factory. And at the time, it was nothing. And he's like, you want to come build this thing with us? And I was like, heck yeah, I do. Count me in. And I spent the last 3 years helping to build out the software factory as a chief of product and chief innovation officer, which is a fake title, but it's a catch-all for everything. And at the end of the day, I was getting pretty bogged down and disgruntled with the bureaucracy and constantly trying to fight for the soldiers and users of our applications and the technology choices we made. And I really got burnt out from it. And I knew I needed to take a step back. And so for the last month now, I've worked for Metro Star Systems. I'm doing a lot of different cool things, but I'm really excited to take that next journey into the private sector, having been in the government for most of my career. Yeah, that's a little bit about me. On the personal note, I love Harry Potter. I love Legos. I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. I will talk about Harry Potter all day, every day with anybody.
That's an important topic because we just lost Dumbledore in real life.
I know. So traumatic. Rest in peace, Michael Gannon.
Yeah. That is, all I've seen is videos of people holding their wands up at all their houses.
That's good.
I love Harry Potter. I love things like that because I love watching the impact things have on our culture and our livelihood and all of the things we have around us. And the impact. As soon as you say Harry Potter, I myself like lit up, like, yes, let me grab my wand. And other people do too, because it's such a great thing. So I love that you mentioned that, because we get so bogged down sometimes in the business world. Oh, work. No, I can't. We can't talk about life. Like, we just got to work and get stuff done.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. There has to be a balance. The notion that like work as a family is, it obscures or downplays the role that your actual family does. And I have a 13-month-old now, and it really came to fruition for me how much it's important to prioritize your family after having a small child that I need to take care of. And I can't be working 16, 17-hour days. It's untenable.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a great segue point. As you grew in your career and became not only a leader of those around you, but an actual leadership role, what was your leadership style, especially when it related to that work balance, that life balance? And tell some stories there.
Yeah, I definitely had to mature as a leader very quickly, moving from kind of an individual contributor role in that biz ops team at Castorana, being chief of staff and having 50 direct reports and a very short amount of time was really daunting. And I really didn't know what it meant to be a manager of people and to be a leader. So I just observed a lot of other leaders in the organization, took kind of mental notes on how they interacted with folks. I read Making of a Manager by Julie Zhao, which I would recommend to anybody. It is like the perfect book. It was the perfect book for me. It was, hey, you've been an individual contributor and then someone forced you to be a manager. This is how to be a manager. And it was just like very clean for me. But over time, I realized that I have a lot of core values in how I see a leader. I'm a leader that values self-governing teams. I will never have the same amount of context as the people actually doing the work. So I have to trust that they know what's right and they can help me understand and advocate for their particular priority or future decision that they want to do. I really want to be a empathetic leader and be someone that people can talk to, that I'm approachable. Vulnerability is something that needs to be shared. People need to be vulnerable with one another, and that behavior needs to be modeled by a leader, that a leader can be vulnerable. And I also just want to be authentic. I see a lot of people put on a face on how they perceive a leader should be. And to me, I want to be myself. Yes, there's some professionalism and ways you want to interact with other people. But at the end of the day, I find the best connections are those when people are just who they are. And that's what I aspire to be and really actively try to practice. I'm very mindful of how I interact with others. And I try to emulate a lot of those things.
I love that. I love what you just said. Or people put on a face, and because it's so true. And some people do it intentionally. They create this other persona and personality to sometimes to protect their other life. But it often, again, people, and you don't know who that actual person is. And so I love that your leadership style you explained, and just your whole journey that way, that she's becoming a doer to a leader. Was that hard? Was it difficult to pull yourself out of the day-to-day work and like actually focus on people and maybe not the product all day?
Oh yeah, it's still a challenge. I am absolutely terrible at delegating. I was getting better over my time at the Software Factory. I had a lot of people around me that would guide and mentor me and coach me on how I can let go more and help, you know, help others be successful around me. But yeah, I still struggle with it. And it's not like I'm trying to control the situation. I just know that it's a lot of work to be done. and I don't want to overwhelm other people. But at the same time, I'm hurting myself because I'm overwhelming myself then with too much work. Because there's never enough resources to get all the things done that you want to be done. So you have to radically prioritize, say no to a lot of things, really keep your team focused. And that requires me to help with that prioritization and kind of move up a level strategically. And that was really challenging for me as somebody who's a very much a doer. I feel like I'm in a somewhat of a doer role right now at the MetroStar, which I enjoy. It's a nice change of pace, but it's a different muscle. It's a different muscle to flex, to be somebody who doesn't write the paper or write the proposal there or put the product strategy together. Rather, you're providing like guidance and some level of oversight and allowing your team and your people to run as they should be, because they're smart people and you brought them on for a reason.
Yes, totally. Oh, absolutely love it. Is there a moment as do you have a most proud moment? I'm going to ask you two questions. So as you become a leader, and have you had a most proud moment as a leader or most disappointing moment as a leader? And I'm not like to like rag on people, but more in just situation and things that they've occurred.
Yeah, like interacting with the leader or like me being in a role and experiencing. Yeah. So probably my most proud like professional milestone is when a software factory, when we got our first application into production, it was like a huge deal. We didn't think we would get there. We didn't think we'd have an ATO. And we were able to get this app in prod with just a small ragtag team. And it was very manual and it was very painful, but we were able to do it. And then we built repeatability over time. But that just like first push to prod is just a huge milestone. And one of the most challenging times I've had is about a year and a half ago, we lost our dev environment. Our dev environment got shut down. There was concerns around the architecture and security of the dev environment. And I spent so many hours building slide decks and briefing leaders about the constraints we had put in and the different security measures we had baked into the process. And we still lost the dev environment. And it was honestly very, felt very traumatic for me because I cared so much. And I realized that after that whole experience of investing so much emotional resources into this, trying to, you know, win this battle for this dev environment, is that I can't, especially in bureaucracy and the government, I can only care as much as the person above me will care. Because if I keep hitting my head against the ceiling and there's not somebody there that's going to help protect me or push or want to change the thing, then there's only so much I can do. And that's the case no matter what position you have in government. If you're an individual contributor on a team, or you have a boss who has a boss who has a boss who has a boss, like that's the sprawling bureaucracy. And sometimes when I was getting frustrated with other situations and scenarios, I just had to remind myself and my team at the time that there's only so much caring we can put in before we harm ourselves in the process. So it requires a lot of resilience to navigate some of the more difficult challenges within the department. And I truly got burnt out from it. And it's part of the reason that I left.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talk about, especially the last couple of years, the government has been overselling the mission stick. Oh, just do it for the mission. Just do it for that. But if we keep doing that, you said it perfectly, you will just burn yourself out. And there is no shame in stopping something that is killing you or that is draining you. And so as you've gone through that, was burnout something that always happened? Let me rephrase the question. As you grew both in your career and how did you prevent burnout or did you, or maybe you didn't, I don't know.
I'm not particularly good at solving for burnout, I'll be honest with you, because I think I'm maturing as a person, a professional person over time, but I just get so invested emotionally into things. And that's what I think makes me like a good worker, because I really do want success and I do want to deliver value. But I can't do it to the detriment of my mental health. And I got burnout at Kessel Run. I got burnout at Army Software Factory. And I'm learning lessons about how I need to better take care of myself in this new role to ensure that doesn't happen. Because I really don't. The feeling of burnout is just, well, I'm sure a lot of people have experienced. Yeah, I'm not unique in this feeling. But it's like you just give up after a certain point. There's nothing left. And I don't like that feeling. I don't want to have to keep repeating that pattern over and over again for myself.
Yeah. And you heard it first, Metro Star, that's listening. Help Hannah not create burnout in her new role.
I literally told my bot that. I was like, please help me prioritize. I'm so bad at prioritizing.
And I'm sure the burnout changed too as you became a mom. As there's a whole different level of exhaustion that came with that. How did that navigate?
Yeah, it is. I had to set boundaries pretty hard when I came back from maternity leave. I was still breastfeeding, so I had to have time to pump during the day. I was going to leave work on time because I used to work late. And I really needed to build that barrier for myself in order to be able to spend time with my son after work. And what's great about kind of my current situation is I'm remote, so I get a little bit more flexibility in how I structure my time. And that's really what's valuable to me. It doesn't feel as daunting to work longer hours because I can work from home, go get my son, play with him. He go to bed and if I need to work after, that's fine. But right now it feels like so much more manageable. But yeah, it took a real shift in my thinking when I came back from maternity leave that, hey, I've got to prioritize this kid.
Yeah, and you were in a very demanding way. Both from your personality, you're going to give everything that you've got, but also as the Chief Product Innovation Officer for Omni Software Factory as a whole, like, you got a lot going on. Tell us a fun story that you had during your time at Omni Software Factory.
Oh gosh, we had so much fun. This is something special about a group of people that are willing to take a risk and take a bet on doing something different. I did not come into Kessel Run when it was brand new. So I didn't have the experience with some of the others with building something totally from scratch. I came in, I was like 100th employee or something. So I was there for a beginning of a big set of growth, but not the same as like the first like 25 people who were pulling it all together with Tori and Adam and Brian and Matt and others. And so when Software Factory, it was three active duty people and me, and we were cobbling together a bunch of stuff to just get help soldiers be able to learn how to build software in a modern way. And we've built such close bonds and friendships and through the muck with each other to see, I think that there's, to see the maturity and the progression of the soldiers' mindsets and career growth is really what's made it really worthwhile to me, especially soldiers who didn't have a technical background or were in a technical MOS or had maybe engineering experience but not product management experience or had security experience but not designer experience. And being able to see them grow is just absolutely wonderful. I'm trying to think if there's like a particular instance. We used to do, the way that the Software Factory is structured is that a cohort of soldiers comes in every 6 months, and up until the fourth cohort, we within my team would have a set of products for them to work on after they finished their 6 month education boot camp portion. And so the first time we did it, I bought like party glasses and played music, and we did a whole announcement on what team people are going to and what work they're going to be doing, and just made it really fun. And those avocado glasses are still around. Like, I saw them as I was leaving Software Factory. People still have their avocado glasses. So if that morale boost piece, I think, is super important.
Fantastic. And it really is. The morale, the mood, little thing is really make a difference. You said something key a minute ago related to service members and software and coding. And how is that journey? How have you seen that journey play out of giving active service members more time behind the computer and actually building these software products?
Yeah, I might be a little spicy here, so I'll try to keep it at like the two peppers. There's the Hannah Hunt spicy scale. Most of my colleagues know about it. It's 1 to 5 peppers level of spice. It's like legit, like it's some emojis and Slack channels. Like we take it very seriously. So something that is really wonderful is that service members have opportunities across all the services on learning how to build software, whether that's in an engineering capacity, product management, or design, and can gain that level of kind of skill set. But some of the struggles from a scale perspective is that you have these efforts that are just training for engineers. Those engineers are then expected to both be product managers and designers whenever they go back to their particular unit. So there's these 12-week immersion galvanized trainings or other types of boot camps, but they're not going to solve the broader problem of that you need soldiers embedded in the process of building software. And I think that's what Army Software Factory has been working towards, is saying, hey, for this future fight, for this future operating environment, you need soldiers in units that have this competency as a balanced product team of product manager, designer, and engineers. And I hope that continues. I hope other organizations adopt a similar model. Kessel Run started out primarily active duty and had folks come in on a TDY capacity for 6 months, but then I think lost a lot of that tie in directly with the airmen. You've got other organizations like FESPIN and others that still have that active duty component, but it feels like it's fewer than it used to be. So I'm hoping that the big DoD realizes that they need to invest in retention of active duty people so that they have a career shield or career progression within the department. They don't have to separate or retire because there's nowhere for them to go after their assignment at whatever innovation hub. So that's like my biggest call to arms, I would say.
Yeah, that's great. You're there. And as you're off in new adventures now, but you have a lot of experience in, across the Air Force and Army software worlds, what do you think, if we get rated at a 1 to 2 spice level, which I love, by the way, for hanging around spice levels, where do you think the DoD needs to go to have a better software plan going forward?
Yeah, I think there's like a bunch of things, but the biggest number one is talent. And people are going to say that over and over again, but truly having career fields, career progression that is not just, I'm a GS-13, so I have to be a supervisor of people or whatever, but can be a technical position where you're just delivering value, to having active duty folks have career progression. They're doing this with data scientists already. So the Air Force and the Army have data scientists, active duty data scientists, Space Force as well. And there's a career progression and career model for them. There needs to be for other types of these skill sets. Only with that, you have this junior lieutenant who can see a pathway, if they want to stay active duty, see a pathway to becoming a general officer, because there's something clearly documented. And that doesn't exist in any service right now. And it needs to desperately. And then the other thing from like a acquisitions perspective that also requires on the civilian side for civilians to get upskilled in how to procure and manage software development. You've got some really great organizations that are innovating on this at a smaller scale, but there needs to be some form of incentive structure that rewards this type of risk taking from doing things differently. Instead of having to do waterfall development, I can actually have users embedded in the process to make sure what I'm building is actually going to be of value to them. So I'd say talent, and then both from an active duty and a civilian perspective, are like the number one thing that needs to change.
And I've seen something happen the last couple of years you've been able to be a part of, and may have been the creator of, I don't know. Look, can you talk about the kind of that Software Factory coalition you guys have been doing before you had left, to bring those ideas and support cross service, cross teams to help each other out?
I cannot take credit for creating it. That would be Angel Faniff and Sadia Copeland. Perfect. From Software Factory. But yeah, the first one that we did, it was just, I was at South by Southwest in 2021, I believe, or 2022. And it was just this most amazing experience to see all these different innovators and change agents across the DoD Software Factory come together and say, hey, we have similar problems. Let's work together. Now there's been subsequent iterations. They've gone to San Diego and Boston. And the next one's coming up, I think, at the end of October, back in Austin. I'm not invited anymore, which is okay. I accept that I've left the dark side, but it doesn't mean I can't to go hang out a happy hour afterwards. But it is, it's a great ecosystem of people who just need a place to, the way Angel calls it, it's just a therapy session. It's a massive therapy session for all these innovators that need the space to talk amongst one another and find solutions together. So it's an awesome group. They're some of the smartest people I know that are part of the Software Factory Coalition. So I'm so glad that it's been going on now for the last year and a half, and it definitely needs to keep chugging along and keeps getting a lot of cachet. Even the DoD CIO team is like very invested in it too. So it's definitely gotten a lot of engagement across senior leadership.
That's incredible. It's been awesome to see it. And I too have been denied of going. I was at the first one, kind of. And then when it became official in some roles I was doing at the time, Angel was like, nope, you know, but I like that because you're, like you said, you're creating a safe place for the government agents to actually go and build things without all the chaos of vendors and contractors and all the different things. As you've been met part of two major software factories over the last many years, are software factories still have validity? Are they still, you think, where we're going forward?
I think so. And everybody has defined software factory different. And anybody you talk to will have their own definition. But in my view, it's a group, it's an organization that focuses on government-led software development. And when government-led, is the government's either acting like a system integrator or they've got government product managers delivering sort of outcomes, you've got active duty folks doing that. That's what all it is. Yes, there's systems and processes in place that make you go faster, utilizing different platform offerings or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's the government's taking ownership of what it's building instead of outsourcing that to a big defense contractor or a series of vendors. The government is actively engaged, and that's what's really needed. You know how you've experienced, I've experienced so many failed software programs, and at the end of the day, the government's like asleep at the wheel. So having that talent inside the government to make those decisions is absolutely critical.
Yeah, that's, I love that. It's great. So what has surprised you about yourself over the last few years as you've grown through your career?
Oh gosh. What has surprised me? I've definitely learned a lot about how I like to operate, if that makes sense. Like I like the way how I like to do work, how I like to engage with people. I became chief of staff at Customer when I was 25. So I had no idea what I was doing. They put trust in me just to figure it out, but surely I didn't really know. And I just had to grow up really fast. I feel like not a lot of 26-year-olds are running a 1,400-person organization. That's crazy. Like, I did get really, I think, honest with myself on what my capabilities were and what I could handle and how I could deal with the anxieties and feeling overwhelmed and relying on those around me, especially in COVID when we were all virtual and by ourselves. Like, it was so important to be able to connect with people. And now it's really made life way more connective. I still have friends in Boston and DC where I used to live. I still talk to them all the time, and that's great. And I think COVID really gave us that. But yeah, I had to learn some deep truth on how I handle conflict, how I handle myself in a very short amount of time.
And is there any lessons learned that you can share with those listening to handle people go conflict? Like, how can someone handle a conflict in the middle of that situation?
Yeah, the best advice I got was mechanisms to provide and receive feedback. So feedback culture is so important because it helps with psychological safety and all those buzzwords, but it also keeps people talking to one another instead of having this kind of catty gossip in the background type of behavior. And feedback needs to be actionable, kind, and direct. That is what it needs to be. People need to be willing to accept the feedback. So I never just give people feedback. I ask if they are willing to receive feedback and then provide it to them. And I have to also be willing to receive feedback, not assume that I take it as that I'm a bad person because I'm so hypercritical of myself, but rather this is a change of behavior that I can make in order to improve and grow. And having that growth mindset, I think, is really critical. So I'd say practice giving and receiving feedback as much as possible. Do it with safe people you feel comfortable doing it with to build that muscle movement. So when you do have to have those harder conversations, like, you've already got the skills in place in order to be able to give that feedback in a kind and actionable and direct way.
That is fantastic. You're making our podcast editor's job really hard because they're going to have to come up with all these great nuggets you're coming out with. And I absolutely love it. I'm going to ask you another question related to the last few years. If you could go back to day one of being asked to be the chief of staff at Kessel Run, what would you tell yourself?
Oh, gosh. I think don't take yourself too seriously. I had, an unreasonable amount of expectations on how I was supposed to do the job that caused me a lot of internal stress. And I didn't need to be perfect immediately. This was a new position. The organization was changing very quickly. I wasn't going to solve everything all at once. And I think I put a lot of expectations on myself early on that I didn't need to.
Would you tell your 5-year-old self the same advice?
Oh, gosh. Matt. I think I would tell my younger self that it's okay to be you. It's okay to feel things. It's okay to be authentic. Just, it's okay.
It's okay. I love that. And it sounds like that's what you'll be telling your son as he grows and can understand you.
Oh, yeah. We are in the phase of temper tantrums when he's just like starting to get them. And I've been very intentional about being like, oh, like trying to name the emotion, doing this like silly parenting stuff. But, oh, I see you're tired. Or I see you're upset. Let me know when you want a hug and I'll give you a hug. And it's been good. I think it helps him. I don't know. He's 13 months. I don't really know what he wants. But it at least gives him something to name when he can start to name his emotions better. And know that my husband and I are here for him and can love him and give him the attention that he needs.
Yeah, I love it. And it's okay to have a temper tantrum. I think in a controlled environment, adults can even have temper tantrums. It's probably therapeutic.
Oh, yeah. That's why people go to those smash rooms or whatever, right? Yeah. To go break stuff.
Yeah, it's totally. Maybe I'll have a temper tantrum office space style with your work printer, although, as we've both been government employees, I would love to have lost a laptop out of a window from time to time.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? Which is almost what happened before I got on this call. I'm so mad. Oh, yeah. My computer.
You're working with government equipment.
Oh, gosh. What a mess.
So as you grow in career, in leadership, what are things you want to try or experiment with, maybe as a leader, like that you haven't done yet?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of different types of organizational styles and organizational topologies that I'd be really interested in experimenting with, like how work is structured, how you're quantifying value, what types of methodologies you're going to leverage. Like, I've done OKRs, I've done growth boards, I've done other types of value, like investment, divestment decisions, but I know there's others and new ones are coming out all the time. And being able to be the most optimal while still having some of that EQ is really what I'm interested in. I think Brené Brown has this great book, Dare to Lead, and it talks about what it means to be a really like authentic and vulnerable leader. I want to take some of her methodologies, the way that she approaches life, and try to implement them organizationally. So I feel like I can work on myself a lot, but how do you get the organization to embrace some of these concepts is a real challenge. It's coalition building at the end of the day, but it also is, you know, making the case that there's different ways of measuring value. So it's the things I've been thinking about and experimenting with on my own, but would love to be able to do that kind of as more transformational effort, both for like government customers now than on the industry side, but also within organizations as well, like MetroStar.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You mentioned something about work structure, how we structure work and things. And something that came to mind is, I'm curious, what's your opinion on the concept that people have to be paid out by hours, like tracking people's work by hour?
Oh, I hate it. And it's actually not for, like, I know some people can work really optimally, and I'm one of those people. So in theory, I wouldn't need to work 8 hours to do 8 hours of work, though I do more than 8 hours a lot of the time. I just think if people are in the zone and they want to like deliver value, they maybe work some overtime. In the government, you're penalized for that. Like I was putting in initially overtime that I was working at Kesselrun and the Army, and I was told, stop doing that. You just need to work less hours. And I was like, the job still needs to get done. So here I am putting in 8 hour days on my timesheet, but I'm really working 11, 12, 13 hours. And so I just think it's a bad incentive structure. I certainly understand from a regulation perspective and from a policy perspective, there has to be some form of accounting system in place in order to track hours, in order for MetroStar or other companies to build a government. I fully understand that. But I also think that there's downsides to it. And I think allowing people to manage their time the most appropriate way is the way to do that. There's other ways to measure performance than just hours worked. And I think most people know that. It's just, unfortunately, I think in America and our culture, everybody's much more comfortable doing hours based.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, especially as I've created my own company and my own time. And someone recently asked, they said, are you just working like 300 hours a week as a business owner? I was like, no, I am lazy efficient. But just because I'm lazy efficient and build processes for my thing doesn't mean I should get paid less just because I do it faster. So I love that you hit that as well. As back as a working mom and a career female, obviously you're a female, obviously you're a leader, but as a mom, if you had magic powers, and since we know you love Harry Potter, we'll use Harry Potter magic. You could wave your wand and change anything for moms or working women in the workplace. What would it be?
Oh, gosh. Such a good question. And can I pick more than one?
Yeah.
I'm channeling my inner Hermione here. So like every organization should have a mother's room. I think legally you have to now, but some of them can be really crappy and dirty and sad and quiet. They should be welcoming and have all the things that you need in order to, you know, actually feed your human. I've heard terrible stories of other women who had to stop breastfeeding because their facilities didn't have adequate mother's rooms. So that's number one, that fundamentals table stakes for working moms. And then the other thing, and this is I don't know if it's just an American thing, but I think it's more acute in America, but I just know a lot of women that go on maternity leave. They think they're going to come back to the same job that they were hired for because that's what you were hired to do. And you come back and you find out things are different. Whatever the difference may be. And I get organizations can't stop while you're gone, but I don't hear that complaint from other countries. Like other countries have year-long maternity leaves I don't hear many women say, oh, I came back and my job was changed, or I lost people that worked for me and they work somewhere else. Like I don't hear that in other country from people that live in other countries or have had babies in other countries. But I've heard it like 5 times because I have a lot of like friends who are new mothers and me and your new mother have experienced this. And I don't know how we fix that because it's not discrimination in like the legal sense, but it certainly doesn't make you feel very welcomed in your organization.
And I wonder if it's even not to take credit away from, but if it's even a mom thing at all or a female thing at all, if it happens, I wonder if it happens in the same way in the American culture or if you had caramel lessons. Because I've been in situations where I've had to be out of work for 2-3 months and it's come similar situation where it's come back and it's, oh, wait, now you're in a different role, you're in a different job. So it might even be more than just mom related, mom time off related, but just culture in general.
Yeah, I think that's a real issue. Like a lot of women like will leave organizations. They'll go on maternity leave. And while they're on maternity leave, they'll look for a new job and then come back from maternity leave and then go work for a new company. Cause there's just a lot of uncertainty in how your role is going to be when you come back. Even though there are those laws in place, it still happens an awful lot. And yeah, I agree. I think it's not just, it's longer periods of absence, whether that's short term or long-term disability or whatever the case may be. And I think that's a real issue with just the workforce in general.
But I don't want to know what your experience with this is. There's a lot of that culture, especially in American business professional culture, you have to be busy to be successful. And have you experienced that? And do you agree with that? Have you tried to implement different ways of that to give people time to think and just breathe without just being go?
Absolutely. I feel like I have that expectation of myself too, that I have to be busy. And if I'm busy, that means I'm doing good stuff. When actually I do need that time to strategically think. Like that's where the good nuggets come out. When I'm in back-to-back meetings or I'm working on writing something or whatever, I don't have the opportunity to think strategically. And those are where those big ideas come out. But yeah, it is certainly a pervasive culture. I think the government in particular instilled that in you as well. You have to work your 8 hours and you better be doing something those whole 8 hours versus being like, hey, and we know that's not true. People don't necessarily always have 8 hours of work or they're talking to their coworkers or whatever the case may be. But yeah, it's definitely a cultural issue.
Is there, as a leader, where do you sit on, now that you are a remote employee, where you sit on more remote or less remote in the future in the workplace?
I think there's a balance. I was talking to somebody about it. And when your company, the most optimal remote type relationship is if your company was all in person and they had formed a culture and a value proposition and then went more hybrid, because there's those culture arms that can keep the culture tightly connected to the people who are remote. I don't know how much I buy that necessarily, but I can certainly say at MetroStar, we're a hybrid company. I'm here, I'm virtual, but a lot of people work out of the headquarters in Northern Virginia, but they also have a lot of other remote folks. And I think that you have happier workers when you give them the flexibility to manage their location and manage their time. And the culture does require you to invest more time in managing the culture when you have a disparate workforce. But that should be the job of the leadership to make sure that's a thing and not to say, oh, you have to be in person because the culture is going to get ruined if it's not. No, like that's a tough challenge and it needs to be solved. And I think a lot of companies are taking that leap. Some that are fully virtual, I think of like Rob and Defense Unicorns being that like that big champion of that remote first organization. Meanwhile, like I feel as integrated as ever, even though I'm in Austin and my boss is in Maryland and my coworkers are in Colorado and Virginia, like we're all over the place. I still feel very much connected to the MetroStar culture.
That's fantastic. Is a little hat tip to MetroStar as you had, I'm sure, the pick of the litter as because of your career you've created to go places. What attracted you to MetroStar as you made that next step?
Yeah, that's a great question. I So it's a few things. They have a very robust and well-documented value proposition for themselves, their cultural values. That's something that I've always found so critical to an organization. They have a huge bias for action. They don't feel like a traditional defense contractor, even though they do a lot of government contracting work. It is an innovative culture, and it has a team that is constantly willing to learn, constantly willing to do things differently, not comfortable with the status quo. And I thrive in those types of situations. And then I'll give a shout out to my friend Joe Early, who was working at MetroStar. He's part of the product and delivery team. And Joe is one of those people that really values a good, like, healthy organizational culture. And I saw that he was working there. I was like, oh, okay, this is probably a good fit for me. So I did have a lot of, like, different opportunities that I was thinking about. I was thinking about going straight commercial and totally leaving the government space. But I think being still in the GovCon and GovTech space is where I needed to be. I really do love supporting the government. I'm just now removed a bit from, like, that day-to-day, which I really needed for my own sanity. But yeah, it's a great company culture. It's got a lot of great people. They're making a lot of investments in a lot of different technologies, but really in their people. And they're not just, like, walking the walk. They're, like, actually doing the things, which is really refreshing coming from the government.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's so exciting to see. And it's always nerve-wracking for anyone that's made the jump from GovCon, any trying to change any type of career. There's a lot. It can be a lot. But going from the government work to contracted work, even though they're close, there's just a lot. So what excites you or has made you nervous? You're like, I'm taking a big new step.
Oh, yeah. I'm learning so much. I've been a contractor before, but on the client side. So I've never worked at the corporate location on the corporate side. And so this is a whole new world for me about how government contracting is structured from the industry perspective. I awarded and worked on a lot of contracts on the government side. I was actually joking with somebody. I was like, yeah, like, us government people really made it hard to work contracts. Like, I didn't realize until even just being, like, a few weeks into government, like, on the industry side, how painful it can be to work with the government, because we have crazy timelines and we expect full-fledged proposals to be written in 2 weeks and just, like, nonsense, like, stuff like that. I didn't really think it was a problem from being in the government, but I gained a lot of empathy and a lot of sympathy to what the government's put contractors into. But it's been a whole new world on, like, how to think about delivery as supporting clients and customers versus trying to do that internally within the government.
Well, that's fantastic. Welcome to the dark side, part of the dirty contractor world.
Yeah, those dirty rotten contractors. Glad to be here.
Flipping back to Hannah as a whole, in 50 years from now, what does success look like? And I'm not talking career, I'm talking in general. Anything you're willing to share. What does joy, happiness, success look like for you 50 years from now?
What would success look like?
Yeah, just like personal success. Doesn't have to be work-related.
I think a nice career work-life balance. I'd love to be, in 50 years, I'd love to be like a bajillionaire. And I can live on a ranch in Montana and manage horses and goats and sheep and whatever. It's a nice dream anyway. Or I think I'll definitely be retired at that point. But I really just want to have a life where I feel content and I feel valued, both internal self-validation and externally. And I have a great group of people around me that just love and support me. And I think that's what anybody can ask for. That's what I would love.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you go for the dream. Go for the ranch. Go for it. Get your sheep and goats and live that Yellowstone lifestyle.
Yeah, heck yeah. My husband loves Yellowstone. Huge fan. Do you know they have Yellowstone branded chili? We saw it at ETB, which is like the grocery chain down here. I was like, no way, this is legit.
Wow. Marketing. They market everything. They brand everything.
They do. They do.
History that has a marketing company. This is a part of the show. Is there anything else you want to share, talk about, questions I haven't asked? Maybe it just comes to mind you want to leave people with.
I think the other thing else I'll say is just be kind to yourself. Life's hard. It's messy. It's difficult. I have to constantly remind myself to be kind to myself. To all the listeners out there, just be gentle and kind to yourself. Do something nice to yourself every day.
Fantastic. That is, and last question is, what reason or what, why would you say anybody should listen to podcast, to this show, to podcasts like this? Future.
Yeah, I think you bring on just an excellent group of people. I saw Rachel was on earlier and Brian Humphreys. Like, it's just innovators in this space that are trying to do things differently that are just wonderful people. It's awesome to hear their stories. I was listening to Rachel's a little bit, who she's amazing also. And just getting to hear other people's stories and their journeys is, I know, it's really that human connection that I think all of us need. Everybody should listen to this podcast. That's what I'd say.
Brilliant. Fantastic. I've really enjoyed having you on, Hannah. It's been a joy finally to be able to sit down. And this might be the longest we've ever spoken because we're always at conferences. We're going all crazy. So I've enjoyed hearing your story and learning your style and helping share that with the world. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
Definitely. If you're still there listening, thank you. I hope you enjoy learning from Hannah. And as always, be a reason. You control your destiny. You can do as Hannah has created her own journey and path and success and created it for many others. You can be the same. And so continue to be awesome and be the reason someone has an awesome day. And Hannah's not going to hang up. But you guys are all going to hang up or turn this audio off. So we'll catch you next time.